Chapter 70. Weeks and months of mourning for Winterburn had been passed by Grace in the soothing monotony of the memorial act to which she and Marty had devoted themselves. Twice a week the pair went in the dusk to Great Hintock, and, like the two mourners in Cymbeline, sweetened its sad grave with their flowers and their tears. Sometimes Grace thought that it was a pity neither one of them had been his wife for a little while, and given the world a copy of him who was so valuable in their eyes. Nothing ever had brought home to her with such force as this death, how little acquirements and culture weigh beside sterling personal character. While her simple sorrow for his loss took a softer edge with the lapse of the autumn and winter seasons, her self-reproach at having had a possible hand in causing it knew little abatement. Little occurred at Hintock during these months of the fall and decay of the leaf. Discussion of the almost contemporaneous death of Mrs. Charmaday Broad had waxed and waned. Fitzpiers had had a marvelous escape from being dragged into the inquiry which followed it, through the accident of their having parted just before under the influence of Marty South's letter, the tiny instrument of a cause deep in nature. Her body was not brought home. It seemed to accord well with the fitful fever of that impassioned woman's life, that she should not have found a native grave. As he had enjoyed, but a life interest in the estate, which, after her death, passed to a relative of her husband's, one who knew not Felice, one whose purpose seemed to be to blot out every vestige of her. On a certain day in February, the cheerful day of St. Valentine, in fact, a letter reached Mrs. Fitzpiers, which had been mentally promised her for that particular day a long time before. It announced that Fitzpiers was living at some Midland town, where he had obtained a temporary practice as assistant to some local medical man, whose curative principles were all wrong, though he dared not set them right. He had thought fit to communicate with her on that day of tender traditions to inquire if, in the event of his obtaining a substantial practice that he had in view elsewhere, she could forget the past and bring herself to join him. There the practical part ended. He then went on, "My last year of experience has added 10 years to my age, dear Grace and dearest wife, that ever erring man undervalued. You may be absolutely indifferent to what I say, but let me say it. I have never loved any woman alive or dead as I love, respect, and honor you at this present moment. What you told me in the pride and haughtiness of your heart, I never believed this, by the way, was not strictly true, but even if I had believed it, it could never have estranged me from you. Is there any use in telling you no? There is not that I dream of your ripe lips more frequently than I say my prayers, that the old familiar rustle of your dress often returns upon my mind till it distracts me? If you could condescend even only to see me again, you would be breathing life into a corpse. My pure, pure Grace, modest as a turtle dove, how came I ever to possess you? For the sake of being present in your mind on this lover's day, I think I would almost rather have you hate me a little than not think of me at all. You may call my fancies whimsical, but remember, sweet, lost one, that nature is one in love, and where 'tis fine it sends some instance of itself. I will not intrude upon you further now. Make me a little bit happy by sending back one line to say that you will consent, at any rate, to a short interview. I will meet you and leave you as a mere acquaintance, if you will only afford me this slight means of making a few explanations and of putting my position before you. Believe me, in spite of all you may do or feel, your lover always once your husband. It was, oddly enough, the first occasion, or nearly the first, on which Grace had ever received a love letter from him, his courtship having taken place under conditions which rendered letter writing unnecessary. Its perusal, therefore, had a certain novelty for her. She thought that, upon the whole, he wrote love letters very well. But the chief rational interest of the letter to the reflective Grace lay in the chance that such a meeting as he proposed would afford her of setting her doubts at rest, one way or the other, on her actual share in Winterburn's death. The relief of consulting a skilled mind, the one professional man who had seen Giles at that time, would be immense. As for that statement, that S.E. had uttered in her disdainful grief, which at the time S.E. had regarded as her triumph, she was quite prepared to admit to him that his belief was the true one. For in wronging herself as she did when she made it, S.E. had done what to her was a far more serious thing, wronged Winterburn's memory. Without consulting her father, or anyone in the house, or out of it, Grace replied to the letter. She agreed to meet Fitzpiers on two conditions, of which the first was that the place of meeting should be the top of Rubdown Hill, the second that he would not object to Marty South accompanying her. Whatever part, much or little, there may have been in Fitzpiers' so-called Valentine to his wife, he felt a delight, as of the bursting of spring, when her brief reply came. It was one of the few pleasures that he had experienced of late years at all resembling those of his early youth. He promptly replied that he accepted the conditions, and named the day and hour at which he would be on the spot she mentioned. A few minutes before three on the appointed day, found him climbing the well-known hill, which had been the axis of so many critical movements in their lives during his residence at Hintock. The sight of each homely and well-remembered object swelled the regret that seldom left him now. Whatever paths might lie open to his future, the soothing shades of Hintock were forbidden him forever as a permanent dwelling place. He longed for the society of Grace. But to lay offerings on her slighted altar was his first aim, and until her propitiation was complete he would constrain her in no way to return to him. The least reparation that he could make, in a case where he would gladly have made much, would be to let her feel herself absolutely free to choose between living with him and without him. Moreover, a subtlest in emotions, he cultivated as under glasses strange and mournful pleasures that he would not willingly let die just at present. To show any forwardness in suggesting a modus vivendi to Grace would be to put an end to these exotics. To be the vassal of her sweet will for a time, he demanded no more, and found solace in the contemplation of the soft miseries she caused him. Approaching the hilltop with a mind strung to these notions, Fitzpiers discerned a gay procession of people coming over the crest, and was not long in perceiving it to be a wedding party. Though the wind was keen, the women were in light attire, and the flowered waistcoats of the men had a pleasing vividness of pattern. Each of the gentler ones clung to the arm of her partner so tightly as to have with him one step, rise, swing, gait, almost one center of gravity. And the buxom bride Fitzpiers recognized no other than Sue Damson, who in her light gown looked a giantess. The small husband beside her, he saw to be Tim Tangs. Fitzpiers could not escape, for they had seen him, though of all the beauties of the world whom he did not wish to meet, Sue was the chief. But he put the best face on the matter that he could and came on, the approaching company evidently discussing him and his separation from Mrs. Fitzpiers. As the couples closed upon him, he expressed his congratulations. "We be just walking round the parishes to show ourselves a bit," said Tim. "First we head across to Delboro, then athwart to here, and from here we go to Rubdown and Millshot, and then round by the crossroads home." "Home," says I, "but it won't be that long. We be off next month."
"Indeed.
Where to?" Tim informed him that they were going to New Zealand. Not but that he would have been contented with Hintock, but his wife was ambitious and wanted to leave, so he had given way. "Then goodbye," said Fitzpiers. "I may not see you again." He shook hands with Tim and turned to the bride. "Goodbye, Sook," he said, taking her hand also. "Wish you and your husband prosperity in the country you have chosen." With this he left them, and hastened on to his appointment. The wedding party reformed and resumed march likewise. But in restoring his arm to Sook, Tim noticed that her full and blooming countenance had undergone a change. "Aloha, me dear, what's the matter?" said Tim. "Nothing to speak o'," said she. "But but to give the lie to her assertion she was seized with lachrymous twitches, that soon produced a dribbling face. "How what the devil's this about?" exclaimed the bridegroom. "She's a little wee bit overcome, poor dear," said the first bridesmaid, unfolding her handkerchief and wiping Sook's eyes. "I never did like parting from people," said Sook, as soon as she could speak. "Why him in particular?" "Well, he's such a clever doctor, that 'tis a thousand pities we shan't see him any more. There'll be no such clever doctor as he in New Zealand, if I should require one, and the thought out got the better of my feelings." They walked on, but Tim's face had grown rigid and pale, for he recalled slight circumstances, disregarded at the time of their occurrence. The former boisterous laughter of the wedding party at the groomsmen's jokes was heard ringing through the woods no more. By this time Fitzpiers had advanced on his way to the top of the hill, where he saw two figures emerging from the bank on the right hand. These were the expected ones, Grace and Marty South, who had evidently come there by a short and secret path through the wood. Grace was muffled up in her winter dress, and he thought that she had never looked so seductive as at this moment, in the noontide bright but heatless sun, and the keen wind, and the purplish-gray masses of brushwood around. Fitzpiers continued to regard the nearing picture, till at length their glances met for a moment, when she demurely sent off hers at a tangent, and gave him the benefit of her three-quarter face, while with courteous completeness of conduct he lifted his hat in a large arc. Marty dropped behind, and when Fitzpiers held out his hand, Grace touched it with her fingers. "I have agreed to be here, mostly because I wanted to ask you something important," said Mrs. Fitzpiers, her intonation modulating in a direction that she had not quite wished it to take. "I am most attentive," said her husband. "All we take to the wood for privacy?" Grace demurred, and Fitzpiers gave in, and they kept the public road. At any rate, she would take his arm? This also was gravely negatived, the refusal being audible to Marty. "Why not?" he inquired. "Oh, Mr. Fitzpiers, how can you ask?" "Right, right," said he, his effusiveness shriveled up. As they walked on, she returned to her inquiry. "Tea is about a matter that may perhaps be unpleasant to you. But I think I need not consider that too carefully." "Not at all," said Fitzpiers, heroically. She then took him back to the time of poor Winterburn's death, and related the precise circumstances amid which his fatal illness had come upon him, particularizing the dampness of the shelter to which he had betakened himself, his concealment from her of the hardships that he was undergoing, all that he had put up with, all that he had done for her in his scrupulous considerateness. The retrospect brought her to tears as she asked him if he thought that the sin of having driven him to his death was upon her. Fitzpiers could hardly help showing his satisfaction at what her narrative indirectly revealed, the actual harmlessness of an escapade with her lover, which had at first, by her own showing, looked so grave, and he did not care to inquire whether that harmlessness had been the result of aim or of accident. With regard to her question, he declared that in his judgment no human being could answer it. He thought that upon the whole the balance of probabilities turned in her favor. Winterburn's apparent strength, during the last months of his life, must have been delusive. It had often occurred that after a first attack of that insidious disease a person's apparent recovery was a physiological mendacity. The relief which came to Grace lay almost as much in sharing her knowledge of the particulars with an intelligent mind as in the assurances Fitzpiers gave her. "Well, then, to put this case before you, and obtain your professional opinion, was chiefly why I consented to come here today," said she, when he had reached the aforesaid conclusion. "For no other reason at all?" he asked, ruefully. "It was nearly the whole." They stood and looked over a gate at 20 or 30 starlings feeding in the grass, and he started the talk again by saying, in a low voice, "And yet I love you more than ever I loved you in my life." Grace did not move her eyes from the birds, and folded her delicate lips, as if to keep them in subjection. It is a different kind of love altogether, said he. It's passionate, more profound. It has nothing to do with the material conditions of the object at all, much to do with her character and goodness, as revealed by closer observation. Love talks with better knowledge, and knowledge with dearer love. Apostrophe, that's out of measure for measure, said she, slyly. Oh yes, I meant it as a citation, blandly replied Fitzpiers. Well then, why not give me a very little bit of your heart again? The crash of a felled tree in the remote depths of the wood recalled the past at that moment, and all the homely faithfulness of Winterbourne. Aunt Ascot, my heart is in the grave with Giles, she replied, stanchly. Mine is with you in no less deep a grave, I fear, according to that. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.